From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, voting rights advocate Anita Johnson talks about her work engaging voters on the ground. Then we learn about the Millennial Action Project and how its founder hopes to bridge the political divide.
We've heard Wisconsin is the tipping point state for this election. I think that's right, but we're also the tipping point state for the future of our political culture. Right now, Wisconsin has become the poster child for divisive, toxic politics.
Contributor Jeanette Hurt finally sets the record straight on why we drink brandy, not whiskey, old fashions.
Once upon a time, we drank old fashions like everybody else. So what happened from 1894 and now? So I kept researching, and I finally found three articles.
Plus an essay about size stigma. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The election is in full swing in the state of Wisconsin. Thousands of voters have already cast their ballots by mail in the Badger State, and early voting is set to begin tomorrow. But there remains some uncertainty among voters, as the pandemic, alongside new laws and regulations, have created confusion. That's where voting rights advocates like Anita Johnson step in. This has been a big year for Johnson. Her work is a key component to engaging voters, and it was recently honored with an award from the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. This month, she received the Robert H. Friebert Social Justice Award from the Federation's Jewish Community Relations Council. She joins me to talk about her work. Anita Johnson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
You're welcome.
So to start here, how did you first become involved in voting rights activism?
You know, I'm hesitating in answering that question because, you know, everything starts out with a job, and then you become involved, and then you become passionate about what you're doing. So, you know, it started out as a job. I don't have a story to tell you. It started out as a job, and then I became passionate about what I was doing, and I stayed in it because I feel that people should be empowered with tools that they need when they go to the polls to vote so they can have an easier time voting. There shouldn't be all of this complication about photo ID and registering to vote. People really should need to be educated on what is expected of them when they go to the polls to vote.
You know, you said, of course, it started as a job and then you became passionate about it. What was it when you first started working in this field that made you passionate? Were there specific people and specific incidents?
People don't know the laws. Your general public does not know the laws that affect them when they go to vote. So they needed to be educated about those laws. And I felt that, you know, this was something that I could do. So people like senior citizens, low-income people, people of color, students would know what's expected of them when they go to the polls to vote.
Yeah. Now, when we look at education, especially for voters, I think there are so many different organizations that approach this in different ways. What have you found as being particularly effective in reaching people?
Well, it all depends on where you go to reach the people. I've gone into senior citizen places to talk to senior citizens who are really our most vulnerable voters because they don't have laptops. If they have to register to vote, you have to go in and assist them in registering the vote or getting an absentee ballot. The students are not sure. Each school has a different regulations for a student to register to vote at their school. People of color are not always sure about the difference between documents needed for an ID and what you need when you go to register to vote. So I go into schools, I go into high schools, and educate the high school students. I go into senior citizen places and I address the issues that they need. I go into churches because I can talk to 200 or 300 people at one time and tell them about the changes in the voting laws and how it will affect them when they go to the polls to vote. So it all depends on who you're talking to as to what information you will give that particular group.
That makes sense. When it comes to, of course, the obstacles that different groups are dealing with, what do you see as some of the biggest obstacles to the ballot box?
Confusion. Confusion about the laws is the biggest obstacle. If you don't have a state ID in Wisconsin, and this is what you need in order to register to vote, people do know you have to go to the DMV to get ID, but they don't know documents that you have to take to the DMV in order to get a state ID. A lot of people don't have, like, perhaps a birth certificate, and people don't know about the petition process that the DMV will do for you to verify your birthplace and your birth county. People don't know. That's one issue that's really outstanding, is getting that photo ID so you can register to vote. People don't know that this photo ID is free. If you go into the DMV and say, I need this ID so I can vote. The second and biggest issue is registering to vote. You first of all have to have a state ID or a driver's license, and it has to be current. If it's not current, you cannot register to vote. You can only register to vote online at www.myvote.wi.gov. If you don't have a computer, if you don't have an iPhone or, you know, one of these tools to help you to register to vote, most people won't register to vote. So it's imperative that we get out in the public to say, we can help you to do this. We can show you what to do. We can assist you at the DMV. We can assist you if you need to get an absentee ballot. A woman called me yesterday. She was not registered to vote, and she wanted an absentee ballot. So I registered her to vote over the phone because she didn't have a computer. And then she said, I need an absentee ballot. And, you know, usually when you get your absentee ballot, you have to accompany that with a picture. And she was like, well, how am I going to send you a picture? And then I said to her, does somebody help you? I don't understand what's going on here. She said, I can't walk. That meant that I could request an absentee ballot for her, and I did not have to send a photo ID with that absentee ballot because she can't move from day to day. So she would not be able to go to the polls to vote. So I was able to request an absentee ballot for her. So see, these are the things. People fall through the cracks because they don't know these little bitty things that is going to help it make it easier for them to vote.
Of course, you said confusion over the law is perhaps the biggest obstacle. But do you see any laws that you think need to change in order to remove some of these obstacles to make voting more accessible?
Sure. First of all, remove the ID law. Wisconsin has one of the worst ID laws in the U.S. It has one of the worst. So if we remove that, that would settle a lot of things. The next thing is the requirement for living in your residence in order to register to vote at the polls. It used to be 10 days. You have to live in your residence in order to vote at the polling site in your neighborhood. Now it's 28 days. These are the things that confuse people.
Why do you see that second law as being particularly problematic?
It's voter suppression. It's voter suppression. How many people know that, you know, I have to live in my residence for 28 days, take proof of residence, in order to register to vote at the polls. Not many. That law was changed a couple of months ago. So somebody goes to the polls and, you know, oh, we can still register to vote on the day of the election. And they go and they say, oh, well, you can't register to vote because you haven't lived in your residence for 28 days. What they can do is go back to their old polling site and vote there if they're a registered voter. But these are the things that people don't know.
Yeah. When we think about accessing the polls, to you, what does real unfettered access to the ballot box look like? If we were living in a more perfect world, what would access to voting look like?
Well, you know what? In some states, when you get your driver's license or your state ID, you're an automatic registered voter. They'll ask you, do you want to register to vote? And they will register you to vote right then and there. That's one thing I think if we did in Wisconsin, that would help a lot. That would be an easier access to people who want to vote.
You know, we see these kinds of things in other states, but we also see them here in Milwaukee, a lot of lines at polling places, a lot of people who are, you know, waiting an hour, 2 hours in order to cast their vote. Is that an issue that you see being fixed in some way at the state level?
Yeah, it's fixed. We have more than 5 polling sites open for November 3rd. People can do early voting. Early voting starts October 20th and it ends November 1st. And there are maybe about 15 early voting sites that people can go to. So I suggest to people that they should go and vote early so they don't have to stand in line on November 3rd. Midtown is open in the morning, the Frank Ziegler building, and there's another site on the south side. They're open from 8 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock in the evening, which gives you a lot of time during the day if you want to go and vote. These places are very clean. They're very sanitized. You normally don't have to stand in line when you do early vote. Make sure you have your photo ID with you when you go to vote on early vote or on November 3rd.
All right. Well, Anita, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
You're welcome.
Anita Johnson is the Wisconsin Coalition Coordinator for Vote Riders, and she does both education and outreach for Souls to the Polls. Johnson recently received the Robert H. Freebird Social Justice Award from the Milwaukee Jewish Federation's Jewish Community Relations Council. After the break, we learn about the Millennial Action Project and how the Wisconsin founder hopes it can bridge the political divide. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. We have just over 2 weeks to go before the presidential election, and it's clear that the country's politics are starkly divided. But there's a Wisconsin native trying to change that. Stephen Olakara is the founder and CEO of the Millennial Action Project. It's a national organization that launched in 2013. The project hopes to recruit young leaders with an interest in bridging political divides. Olakara is part of the documentary The Reunited States, which is being featured at the Milwaukee Film Festival. It follows 4 Americans trying to reach across the aisle and build relationships between people who are not ideologically aligned. Olakara spoke to WUWM's Susan Bentz about why he started the Millennial Action Project.
I was in Madison during the uprisings in 2011. I was also working on some higher education reform efforts. And as I would interact with state legislators, I quickly realized I was one of the few people talking to both Democrats and Republicans. In my experience growing up, it made sense to be building coalitions in order to create change. And yet, that was such a foreign concept in the state legislature. So the result of that was a lot of good ideas were dying simply because of partisanship, based on who proposed it and whether or not it was a Democrat or a Republican. And every idea was pigeonholed into a left or right Democrat or Republican idea. And I would suggest our solutions were more post-partisan in nature. And so I started talking with some of my friends in Madison, and I would see how their views were more nuanced than just what the party orthodoxy is supposed to be, but they didn't have a space to really express that. And I said, well, that's wrong. And that, of course, was a microcosm of what we were seeing nationally, where our political culture has become so toxic. And so that led to the original idea of Millennial Action Project. But then, of course, there's a big gap between an idea being on paper versus being a living, breathing organization. And so I had a few co-founders at the time who were also interested in public service and were just as concerned as I was about the polarization. But we were all looking at each other like, who's crazy enough to jump into this full time? And I had two profound experiences that led to my decision to that question. One was, I was standing in front of the Dr. King Memorial, and I was looking at the quotes on the wall, seeing Dr. King's conviction for a society that was connected, that was linked together in his words, a web of mutuality, and also inspired by the years underneath those quotes that indicated to me just how young he was. I mean, Dr. King was only 26 years old when he led the Montgomery bus boycott. Every quote on that wall was delivered by a man in his 20s and 30s. So that was one experience, because in some ways it would have been easier to wait 10 years and build up a network of philanthropists and have more elected leaders in my network in order to really launch this in a more convenient way. But I think Dr. King's experience tells us that we can't wait. He talked about the fierce urgency of now. And the second experience I had was reading my favorite novel, and it's The Alchemist. And one of the takeaways in The Alchemist is, when you walk in your purpose, the universe starts to conspire for your success. But to pursue that purpose, you usually have to take a leap of faith. And so it was clear in my heart what the right thing to do in that moment was. And I took the leap of faith and ultimately got MAP off the ground. And there have been many moments along the way that have been so improbable that in some ways it could only be explained by the universe conspiring. The experience that really sharpened our methodology was a 2-year-long dialogue series that we held here in Wisconsin. It was called the Red and Blue Dialogues, and it was an experiment to see if whether we could come to the state that some studies have shown is the most polarized in the entire country, the state that was seen as the tipping point state for the presidential election in 2016, where a state where the majority or the Speaker of the House in the state legislature said he has a non-existent relationship with a Democratic governor. Whether in this state we could start to build those bridges of empathy, compassion, and understanding across the aisle. And we did that with community members and elected officials in communities across Wisconsin. And we learned through that process how important it was to start with an open mind. We always asked people as part of these dialogues not to make broad generalizations or to feel like they have to represent a whole group, to speak from your own, you know, personal experience. And when you break down those barriers, you see what one woman said to me after one dialogue, where she said, hey, Stephen, we're just agreeing too much, and didn't realize that as a liberal, she was sitting next to the local head of the Republican Party. And so when she was able to see the person sitting next to her as a human being with real life experiences, with positive intentions, there was so much more common ground to find. And that translated to the elected officials as well. And I'll never forget, actually, there after one of our dialogues we had out in Brookfield, it was focused on environmental issues. And there was a Democrat who came up to me afterwards and pointed at the Republican elected official who was there and said, you know, I'm really starting to like that guy. But most importantly, it was just seeing the power of trust and the power of relationship building and the power of creating the right context for people. And ultimately, it all added up to the power of listening.
The methodology you're talking about, did you borrow that or create it?
I think we created it. I would say there are three parts to our methodology. One is building relationships. Two is, and part of building relationships is listening. The second is reframing issues and helping our legislators with policy ideas. And then the final thing is helping to amplify success stories and weave each of these victories into a larger narrative about a building the case for bridge building. And that's sort of the call and response where our democracy works best when we're kind of having these live conversations. And that's why narrative is so important. So I would say our future summit is an annual event that we put on. And that's one event that brings all three of those things together, the relationships, the policy, and then the narrative building.
So now you find yourself in Wisconsin full time. Over the course of MAPS history, you've been back and forth,
yeah.
But now you are here. So do you think of the pandemic as offering you this unique opportunity to try to break down these political barriers that we've talked about, since Wisconsin is such, I'll put it unceremoniously, a mess? Or was this your design before the pandemic hit?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say it was my design before the pandemic hit. My reason to be so focused on Wisconsin right now is not only because it's my home state, this is where I grew up, where I, you know, went to school, went to college, where my family is, but also because I see Wisconsin as the central arena for the future of our democracy. We've heard the phrase over and over again, Wisconsin is the tipping point state for this election. I think that's right, but we're also the tipping point state for the future of our political culture. And right now, Wisconsin has become the poster child for divisive, toxic politics in many ways. Just look at the number of national pieces, national articles that have been written about that. But I see Wisconsin in a different light because by far the most unique thing that anyone realizes when they come to visit the state is how nice the people are and how they feel this warm sense of hospitality among Wisconsinites. I think that culture is really at our core, and I would like to see Wisconsin become a leader for political bridge building. And that's essential in our state because we're roughly evenly split between Democrats, Republicans, and Independents. So we can't move forward together if we're not working together. And so if we can figure out how to make that type of politics work here in Wisconsin, I think that's just going to ripple across the country. So I'm really putting my head down now in Wisconsin, working with local groups, partnering with a number of organizations, working with our lawmakers here on both sides of the aisle, and trying to change the narrative, but also change the methodology of how we do business here in the state. In many ways, I see our national politics starting to infect our state and local politics, but in many ways, those most extreme voices are crowding out the reasonable voices that we have here in the state and that we have here locally. And I think our job is to try and elevate those voices as much as possible and do something that's central to Millennial Action Project, and that's modeling the leadership that we want to see. Every day we can try and be, you know, a role model for bridge building and change. And I think that's a uniquely American tradition to approach things with that approach. That's what our founding fathers imagined, that America would eventually become a large and diverse country probably more diverse than they ever imagined. And these types of principles of bridge building are essential for that vision to come to life.
Doesn't the pandemic and the way so many levels of our leadership are not handling it together just make you want to throw up your hands?
Yeah, well, I think I remember in the first days of the pandemic, I brought my team together and I remember mentioning that this pandemic is going to expose some deep-seated problems in our country. And we see how it's exposed the racial and socioeconomic divide, but also the political divide as well. When leaders can't work together to solve a public health crisis that affects all human beings, it shows that we're incapable right now of solving big problems. And I think the experience we've had in Wisconsin is a really good example of that, where there's so many problems that have gotten worse simply because of political partisanship. And those are self-inflicted wounds. These are preventable things. And that's why people often say, like, oh, like, you know, bridge building and love and empathy, like, these are very cute concepts. It's like, no, this is life or death stuff, and it's hard. One of my mentors has this great line. He says, bridge building is not rocket science. It's much harder. And I think the pandemic has showed just how hard it is. And it also shows that this new politics we speak of can't just be switched on like a light switch. Because when a pandemic hits, you can't start building bipartisan relationships from scratch. Because if you've already been engaged in a slash and burn style of politics, now you can't just turn around and say, hey, can you work with me on this? You know, so it really requires years and years of building up. And so, yeah, when I look at what's happened here in Wisconsin and what's happened nationally, it's yet another sign that this rampant partisanship is deadly for our country. When you look at the election debacle we had back in April here in Wisconsin and the back and forth of whether or not we are going to have an election, are we mailing out ballots, and the court cases, I mean, that was just a complete breakdown of our political system, where even the night before, voters didn't even know, are we voting tomorrow? And then it led to an unprepared election and people lining up in lines. And that's where, again, it was clear that this polarization is leading to deadly consequences, and we need to, you know, see it in that light. So, yeah, I hope the pandemic is just kind of a wake-up call for people, and the turbulence we're going to see in our country after this election is likely another wake-up call for our country, because these trends are just unsustainable. And one thing that gives me hope is, you know, Dr. King would sometimes say that the stars shine brightest in the dark of night. And so sometimes when things get really bad, you have the possibility of new structures, new ways of doing things, new leaders emerging. And I'm placing my bets on that.
Stephen Olakara is a Brookfield native who founded the Millennial Action Project. He spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz. Olakara is featured in the film The Reunited States as part of the Milwaukee Film Festival, and he'll be part of a virtual panel discussion about the film this evening. You can find more information at WUWM.com. Coming up next, Lake Effect contributor Jeanette Hurt shares the true reason behind why Wisconsinites love brandy old fashions. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
There are plenty of cocktails that Wisconsin has laid claim to, like the Brandy Old Fashioned, a Bloody Mary with a beer chaser, or the incomparable Tom and Jerry. In a state that continuously ranks in the top margins for alcohol consumption, Wisconsin's drinking traditions aren't just cherished, they've rarely changed. Lake Effect contributor Jeanette Hurt's latest book is called Wisconsin Cocktails and explores the history and tradition surrounding many of the Dairyland's favorite drinks. She joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share some surprising old-fashioned history and recommend cheese pairings for drinks.
Jeanette Hurt, welcome back to Lake Effect. It's great to have you back.
It's great to be here, Audrey, and I'm really excited about the subjects we're going to talk about today.
Me too. I am ready with cheese near me, which is the best part of this. And but before we get to the cheese, you have a new book out called Wisconsin Cocktails, and it's, of course, filled with great recipes and history of some of our favorite drinks. But I feel like the most important thing we need to take away from this and start our conversation with today is setting the record straight on why Wisconsinites love and consume brandy, but more specifically, the Brandy Old Fashioned. So what's the common story that you had heard and been told to up until you dug into more research for this book?
Well, the story goes that the good Korbel brothers were at the Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893. And because this exposition was so popular, a whole bunch of Wisconsinites came down. And there were so many neat things there. Captain Pabst displayed his beer, which won a ribbon, but it wasn't blue, actually. We had Aunt Jemima's pancake mix, which was really popular. We had the very first brownies. And then, of course, there was brandy from California. And the story goes that because the Korbel brothers were displaying their brandy in the California Pavilion of the Columbia Exposition, you know, people came there, they loved it, and Wisconsinites started drinking brandy. Now, that sounds really interesting, and that's the story that I even wrote about at one time. But when I was working on this book, I'm like, every time I've talked to the folks at Korbel, they would say, well, we can't confirm that. So I'm like, well, what is really going on? So what I did is I did some investigative historical research, and I did basically the equivalent of looking at more than 200 years worth of newspaper microfiche to go and check every reference, printed reference for brandy and Wisconsin and cocktails. And what I discovered, finally, it was one of those things like one article would lead to another. And the first interesting thing I discovered is there was a cocktail revolution in Milwaukee in 1894. So this is a year after the World's Fair. And they talked about how the young German men, because of course women didn't drink, supposedly.
No.
and beer wasn't good enough. They wanted something more. They wanted the new cocktails. And they talked about cocktails that were popular in Milwaukee in 1894. And they had one cocktail that had brandy in it called a bracer. And then there was a cocktail called the Old Fashioned. But it's the Old Fashioned that everybody else drinks around the country, not Wisconsin. It's bitters, sugar, and whiskey. So I was like, okay, once upon a time, we drank Old Fashions like everybody else. So what happened from 1894 and now? So I kept researching, and I finally found three articles. And one of them was an article in the Milwaukee Journal where this guy took an investigative report approach to why do we drink brandy? Because everybody else said, well, it's kind of like UFOs. We don't know, but it just happens. It's a phenomenon. But finally, this reporter discovered a guy who had been in the liquor distribution business in Wisconsin since 1937. So post-prohibition to now, to at that point, the 70s. And he basically said, well, at one time, yeah, we drank more brandy than other people, but two times nothing is still nothing. What he said is back post-World War II, when there was a lot of bad booze going on, we're talking there were shortages, in part because there were voluntary shutdowns of distilleries so grain could be shipped to Europe because people needed food. And because of that, we had a lot of bad booze floating around. But Wisconsin distributors found a cache of something like 30,000 cases of really good aged Christian Brothers brandy, and they bought it up. So in Wisconsin, if you could get bad whiskey or good brandy, Rotgut rum or good brandy, what were you going to drink? You were going to drink brandy. So people started drinking their cocktails with brandy. And then what was interesting, because I also traced back all these newspaper articles, and what I noticed, besides coming up with this investigative article, I found an article in the 1940s, which talked, it was called a Wham Doodles, which is just these little cute, funny news items in the Milwaukee Journal. And it said something like, a Midwestern distributing company bought enough brandy to float a ship. It was really funny and cute. And that was confirmation of what this other guy was saying. What I also noticed is once we started drinking brandy, brandy makers started marketing to Wisconsin. And it was really interesting because in the 1940s, the Milwaukee Journal also, from an earlier time, their advertising department used to survey readers and ask them, well, what's your favorite toothpaste or your favorite car? And what were you drinking at home? And at that time, again, because women didn't drink, the men who bought liquor for home use were drinking more whiskey than brandy. Now flip over to the same survey about 15 years later, and they were surveying Milwaukeeans on what was their favorite brandy to drink. So that's what happened.
You know, so it's definitely not as romantic as a great discovery at a Chicago fair. It's more so we bought up a good product and now we prefer it, and then marketing follows. So how does the lasting legacy of like Korbel in Wisconsin continue on?
Okay, well, there are a couple things also, which I found interesting. First of all, the way the story got started was there was an article in a Madison paper. This guy was wondering his whole life, well, why do we drink brandy? And he was researching the Columbia Exposition and discovered an article published in a Northern Illinois newspaper, which said, had this whole thing about brandy. And he's like, aha, that's my eureka moment. That's why we drink brandy. Because the German folks went to Illinois and they drank the brandy and they brought it back and it was so popular. And then the story got retold. The story was published in 2004. So then people started telling it. The other interesting thing about Korbel and the Columbia Exposition is there were 25 makers of brandy in the California Pavilion who exhibited at the fair. Korbel was just one of them. And there were other German immigrant wineries that made upwards of four types of brandy that were exhibited at the fair. Post Columbia Exposition in Chicago, the German government in Germany bought the most brandy they had ever bought from California. So there is a connection with German and brandy, but it was actual Germany, not German immigrants. The other interesting thing that I found is Korbel stopped making brandy in Prohibition. And once I found that out, that also was one of those things that triggered me to delve deeper. But Korbel in the 1960s had a really clever advertising campaign. Something like, for a nickel more, you get so much more in quality. And that appealed to our sense of thrift and also still wanting quality. So Korbel was really smart in their marketing campaign. And once they started remaking brandy in the 1960s, of course they marketed here. And the interesting thing about, of course, the story that was published in Madison, the whole eureka moment about this is why we drink brandy in the age of the internet and people searching and people talking. And that's the other thing. If you talk to bartenders and you get taught and you order an old fashioned, they might tell you that story because they read it or they heard it and they retell it. And that's something also about bar history and spirits history. It's hard to figure out the origin of some of our cocktails. But this one I feel very solid about, and I feel really good setting the record straight.
With this revelation is just one of the many awesome things about your book and all the cocktail recipes in it, because the old fashioned, while we still enjoy it, pretty basic, or even with Sprite, 7-Up, Squirt, all the things, and now it's ranged to such new inventions, like a new old fashions and really sophisticated recipes that play off of this. But before we get into that, I'd be remiss to not talk to you about cheese as our cheese contributor. And cheese and cocktail pairings is something you bring up in your book, and that's probably not something many people think of.
Well, they don't think about it, but if you've ever had a Bloody Mary here in Wisconsin, one of the many meal toppings on top of your Bloody Mary is always cheese. So we have been pairing cheese with cocktails for a while. People think of cheese and wine, or cheese and beer, or maybe even cheese and cider, but spirits also have the same complexities. The things you have to keep in mind, though, is with spirits, especially if you're pairing straight, they're a little bit, for the most part, harder to just go head on. But the same basic pairing sort of principles apply to spirits and cocktails that also apply to wines and beers.
So we have three cheeses that you recommended. So we'll start, how about with the Gouda? And so briefly describe like the kind of profile of this Gouda and what cocktail or spirit this would go well with.
Okay, this is a Marika Gouda aged 6 to 9 months. If you smell it, it smells creamy, it smells grassy, and when you taste it, it's got that a little bit of earthiness, but a lot of butter. It goes very well with bourbon, rye, whiskey-based cocktails. It's got some heft and depth to it. I would also say there's some little bit of maybe some tropical fruit essences or flavors a little bit. So it go really well with rum as well.
Well, the taste is smoother than I expected based off the smell.
It's just, it's really creamy. It's one of those cheeses. Anytime I do a cheese class and I have this cheese, it's usually one of the cheeses that is gone by the end of the class. That one would be a good one for a straight brandy old fashioned.
Excellent. Well, while I finish the second piece of Gouda, let's go. We have a bit of a sweeter side today. There is a Hennings apple cheddar cheese.
Yes. Kerry Hennings is known for his ginormous, huge, huge wheels of cheddar. But he and his son is working on becoming a master cheesemaker, just like his father. It's a lovely, lovely cheese company, and it's based in Kiel, Wisconsin, in Sheboygan County, just a little north of us. But they do these flavored cheddars that are amazing. But this apple cheddar, first of all, if you smell it, it smells like apple. So any hard cider-based cocktail, and there are some cider-based cocktails in my book, goes with this cheese. I would also recommend making a brandy old-fashioned using apple-based brandy, like Great Lakes has an apple-based brandy. You could also use a regular brandy. A good one made locally is Central Standard, makes a great brandy. And you could put it, but top it instead of with soda, top it with hard cider. And that, again, perfect pairing. But with the apples, I would think it could also pair with like some different liqueurs.
Well, moving still on the sweeter kind of seasonal trajectory, there's this Cello pumpkin spice fontal cheese, and it smells delicious. Like the way the apples smelled for our last cheese, this smells just like pumpkin spice.
Well, this cheese would pair very well with Great Lakes Distillery. They have a seasonal pumpkin spirit, which is out right now. And you could throw this in a mug of hot cider and it would pair really well. But you could throw the pumpkin-based spirit. You could make a sweet apple martini or a sweet teeny. That's the other thing. Apple martinis would go with the apple cheddar cheese. That would be fantastic. But speaking of the pumpkin spice, it goes well with the chai liqueur. Again, the spices, But what I really like about this also is this morning I tasted it, not with liquor, but with coffee, black coffee. And it just was phenomenal. It sort of softened the edges of the coffee, but the coffee brought out warmth in the cheese. So coffee-based cocktails would go really well with this cheese. But also, for example, Great Lakes Distillery makes a coffee liqueur made with locally roasted Valentine coffee. And there's a recipe in my book for a White Russian using that, and also Goodland Orange. This would be a phenomenal pairing with it. And that's the other thing. We talked a little bit about coffee. Coffee and teas also pair really well with cheese. If you don't drink alcohol, you can still enjoy a really good pairing that matches up perfectly.
With this pumpkin spice cheese, I mean, that's definitely something you want to get a little bit of this spice rind on, like, a tasting. It's really delicious.
It's a lovely cheese, and it's sort of like the Fontel. It's sort of a riff of an Italian Fontina cheese, but not quite. And it's made by Schumann Cheese, which is up in the far northwestern corner. And I got to visit them once, and it was, they have a lovely operation. And the Cello cheese, it's very approachable. And with the pumpkin spice, again, it's something like you're like, well, are we over pumpkin spice? Not really. And if this is one of those, it's like, it sounds kind of odd, but once you taste it, does it taste odd or does it taste delicious? I think it tastes amazing.
Yeah, I agree. These are all some really good suggestions. And Jeanette, I want to thank you so much for sharing them with us. And we'll have you back to give us plenty of more cheese and cocktail drink ideas.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for allowing me to set the record straight on why we drink brandy in our old fashions.
Lake Effect contributor Jeanette Hurt is a freelance writer in Milwaukee and author of several books on food and drink, including her latest called Wisconsin Cocktails. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski. Jeanette Hurt will be doing a virtual event tomorrow night for Stella's Cocktail Dive, hosted by the Southeast Wisconsin Festival of Books and Books and Company. We'll take one last break, then hear an essay on how sizeism can impact health outcomes. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers. Sizeism, or size discrimination, is the idea that people are prejudged or discriminated against because of their body type or size. Sizeism can cause problems in a person's workplace, social circle, and love life. It can also affect healthcare and health outcomes, especially among women of color. Community activist and essayist Jessica Young touches on the negative consequences of sizeism in her essay, Black Women and Size Stigma.
I'm a white 30-something Wisconsinite woman, and I identify with writers and activists like Tess Holliday, Roxane Gay, Sonia Renee Taylor, and your fat friend on Instagram. I also identify as fat. I'm married to a normal-sized man, and I work in human resources, go hiking, do yoga, eat pizza, vegetables, cheese, and drink beer. I was 6 years old when I learned that I was fat, and that fat was shameful, ugly, non-feminine, not worthy or respectable, disgusting, and my fault. I grew up in Wisconsin, a place often satirized with farmlands and fat white farmers. My teen years were filled with adult women's business casual clothing from Lane Bryant, because sizes above 18 did not exist elsewhere. At my lowest weight, I was encouraged to join Weight Watchers. My whole life, I've been acutely aware of discrimination against fat people in healthcare. Researchers and doctors are calling weight, size, fat stigma a public health crisis. I once had pain in my wrist and was told it was because I had gained 5 pounds. A few doctors later, I found out I had carpal tunnel. When I had a miscarriage, my OBGYN told me that my glucose was likely the reason for miscarriage, despite having just passed a 3-hour glucose test. After pointing this out, she quickly changed her story to explain that in the first trimester, miscarriages are high due to genetic issues. She also didn't believe that I ate vegetables. Working for a large healthcare organization, I have seen firsthand how an institution struggles with addressing weight stigma in general. In the current pandemic, obesity is listed as a risk factor for COVID-19, despite no direct evidence linking body size and COVID-19 severity. The assumption being that fat people have underlying health conditions or are not living a healthy lifestyle. Fatness has been a discriminating factor in whether a hospitalized COVID-19 patient will receive a ventilator when there is a shortage. Despite experiencing size discrimination myself, I must acknowledge my privilege as a white woman. One of the most important things I've learned regarding the history of weight size discrimination is that it disproportionately affects Black women, and the history of sizeism is based in racism. This means that there is current size discrimination, the history of which is based in racism, already existing in healthcare, and the disparities for Black women are intensified due to the pandemic. Our country and our community are experiencing unprecedented stress and trauma that has started to make space for incredibly hard truths and discussions. It is my hope, but also imperative, that we immediately include weight discrimination in the conversations we're having about racial disparities in healthcare in order to fully address how weight discrimination compounds the disparities for Black women of size. In a few years, obesity stigma will be part of history as one of the many disease stigmas that disproportionately affects a population. Like cholera, Irish immigrants were blamed. Tuberculosis, African Americans were blamed. HIV/AIDS, the LGBTQ community was blamed. And right now, fat people, specifically Black women, are being blamed for their weight and size. Obesity stigma and weight discrimination are directly related to racism, and healthcare must be part of the conversation so we can do right by Black women and people of size in this country as we move forward toward justice, equity, and inclusion.
Jessica Young is a community activist and writer living in Wauwatosa. She writes short stories, poetry, and essays about women, equality, and fat advocacy. You can hear more of her stories on her podcast, You Maybe Know Her. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.